said of Casper with the splendid table. Today, it's the stealth grape, the mysterious Zinfandel. You haven't heard of the Zinfandel mysteries? Welcome to the Inside Edition of The Wine World. But never fear, historian Charles Sullivan has unraveled Zinfandel's controversial past. Olive Stearns have gone behind the bulletproof glass for great barbecue at Leon's in Chicago. We have the sexiest new bread gear from baking expert Dory Greenspan. New York food guy Mike Colomeco tours us into the city's oldest Indian neighborhood, Curry Hill. And the legendary Alice Waters is brewing another revolution in public schools. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow. Talk to me nice, talk to me nice, you've got to wine me and dine me. Don't try to fool me, be you me, either amuse me or lose me. I'm getting hungry. Peel me a grape. Pop me a cork, French me a fry, crack me a nut, bring a bowl full of bonbons, chill me some wine, keep standing by, just entertain me, champagne me, show me you love me, kid, love me, best way to cheer me, cashmere me, I'm getting hungry. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, jump to it. Sent out for scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rub me, don't bug me, new thunder burn me, you heard me, I'm getting hungry. Here's how to be an agreeable chap. Love me and leave me in luxury's lap. Hop when I holler, skip when I snap. When I say do it, scotch, boil me a crab, cut me a rose, make my tea with the petals, just hang around, pick up the tab, never outthink me, just mink me, polar bear rug me, don't bug me, new
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's the mystery grape, the great Zinfandel, the fruit steeped in controversy, its origins lost in the mists of time. Yeah, this kind of stuff goes on in the wine world. But that world has a meticulous historian, Charles Sullivan. After 30 years of research, he's written Zinfandel, A History of a Grape and Its Wine. Well, you give me one cool night and I am primed to start kneading bread, which is why baking expert Dori Greenspan joins us with her picks of the best bread gear. Our go-to guy in New York, Mike Colomeco, guides us through Curry Hill. The woman who pioneered California cuisine and organics in the restaurant is fermenting a new revolution in public school cafeterias. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. So let's start things off the way we do every week with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Starbucks, offering Black Apron Exclusives coffee. The Sterns write the road food column in Gourmet magazine. So, Jane, Michael, I understand you've made yet another, perhaps what I think of as monthly treks to Chicago.
And well-deserving it is of a monthly trek, because we were in Chicago recently eating some of the most delicious barbecued ribs I've had anywhere in the country.
Not hot dogs, Michael?
Not this. Well, we did have a couple of hot dogs on the side, but I won't even talk about them today, because what we must talk about is the ribs at Leon's Barbecue on the south side of Chicago.
Now, we've been eating at Leon's as long as we have been together, which is 34 years. I mean, Leon's is a Chicago institution, a south side institution.
But what style of ribs? Is there a Chicago style of rib?
Well, there are a couple Chicago styles. I mean, many people in Chicago love the baby back ribs, which are those really tender, delicate, kind of fall off the bone ribs. And they're fine for what they are, but Leon serves soul food ribs, which are spare ribs, big, meaty bats with meat that kind of, you want to tear it off the bone with your teeth. And and the chewing of that meat rewards you with just tidal waves of flavor that the baby backs just cannot deliver.
Now, here's the downside of eating at Leon's. You have to order and pay through a bulletproof window. It's not in...
Really?
You're not going to take your grandmother here for her 80th birthday party.
We would also suggest you eat at Leon's during the day. There's also no tables or chairs. And the ribs are this big sloppy thing that comes wrapped in paper. So you either have to eat them in your car and, you know, slop up your car, or drive 80 miles an hour to the nearest table.
Well, we made the terrible mistake of trying to eat on the trunk of our car. It was a rental car, so who cares how much the sauce gets on the trunk? So we opened up the ribs on the trunk of the car and were suddenly set upon by what seemed like literally flocks of seagulls who hover around Leon's lot waiting for suckers like us to open up their meal.
There's a little group on Lake Michigan that says, hey, they're at Leon's. Come on, guys.
The Sterns are back.
But isn't this the reason you have a hotel room in a place like Chicago?
Yeah, but the hotel room is probably 25 minutes from Leon's.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Could you wait 25 minutes to take it to a hotel?
So, I mean, I don't think so. Sweet, spicy ribs. And do they do stuff other than ribs?
They do. The ribs have a sauce. They're really wet ribs with a barbecue sauce that isn't, it's a little bit sweet, but quite hot. I mean, very spicy hot.
I think they have mild or hot.
We got the hot, and it's pretty darn hot. I mean, not ferociously so, but hot enough so that your lips will tingle for several hours after you eat these ribs. And there are other things on that. First of all, you can get ribs or rib tips. They also have one of the most wonderful hot links I've ever had. You know, that's the sausage.
Right,
that is typically sold in a barbecue place.
As you can tell, Michael's trying to sneak a hot dog.
I'm getting close to hot dog hood here. But in fact, the weird thing about this hot link was that it was one gigantic sausage that I swear was an Italian-style sausage, like you get in all of the Chicago Italian beef stands. But it was covered with this kind of soulful barbecue sauce, so it was Italo soul food sausage.
And I have to say my favorite thing are the rib tips. I don't know why, and they're always the cheapest thing on the menu, but I think they're a little bit more crunchy, chewy yeah. to eat.
I love rib tips. I know what you mean.
They're so good. And there's more sauce per square millimeter.
Well, the best thing I have to say about the presentation is whatever you get, it comes in a kind of cardboard boat with the sauce on top of it. And on top of the sauce are two or three slices of the blandest white bread in the world that by the time you're like midway through has completely disintegrated.
I thought that was a napkin.
Yeah, well, it serves the function of a napkin, but it's bread.
I do love the bulletproof window because when you place your order, you have to say, ribs! So they can hear you.
Well, guys, another trip to Chicago. Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Barbecued ribs. They're crisp and brown. The best in town. You can pick them right up and eat them with your fingers. When the ribs are gone, the taste still lingers.
The Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Each week, we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish. This week, it's chicken slices in Sicilian mint sauce. This is one of those things that you can serve hot or cold, and leftovers are dynamite on salad. We also send along techniques and shopping tips, but best of all, the newsletter is free. So sign up at that place where all life's little problems are solved, splendidtable.org. Dory Greenspan writes cookbooks that are award winners. She's a master baker, and she can't resist test driving kitchen equipment. Her column, Tools of the Trade, appears every month in Bon Appetit. And Dory comes by regularly to talk about what we cook with. Dory, good to have you back.
Thanks, Lynn. Good to be with you.
Dory, what do you think of those baking baskets? You know, the rising baskets that you see?
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Are they worth the money?
You know, I love them. I love them for all the right and all the wrong reasons.
Uh-huh.
All the right reasons. Oh, let me tell you the wrong reason first. I just think they're so pretty.
Well, that's
sorry.
I understand. So, I hear you.
They're really beautiful. The Bannetons, which are the very tightly woven willow baskets that are lined with Belgian linen, are so beautiful that just owning one makes me, you know, it just transports me to Provence. I'm in the French countryside in a stone kitchen. But the fact is, they really do work, and they're just about indestructible. You'll have them for a lifetime. The Belgian linen really holds the dough. You flour the linen very well,
mm-hmm.
and the basket will give your dough shape, and it will turn out of the linen without sticking. And they are expensive. They're about $70 a basket, but they're so beautiful. And when I go to bread bakeries in France and I see those baskets lined up, these are the baskets that the bakers have had for years.
Mm-hmm.
So they really, it's a big investment, a less costly investment, and it's just as pretty. You use it a little bit differently. Are the German baskets, they're called Brotform, Brotform, and they're round, they're unlined, and those are the baskets that have concentric circles of
right.
And if you flour, well, you have to flour them. You flour them, put your dough in. When you turn them out, those beautiful circle lines are shown. They'll be there on your dough, and they'll show up beautifully after the bread is baked and there's flour on top of them. So, and they're $30. I mean, I think they're worth it. I also think that, you know, bread baking is, it's such, I think of it as aromatherapy. I think of it as therapy, actually,
yeah, yeah.
Because there's so much that you do is by hand. And there are so many little things that you can work with out in bread, but that are fun to have around. I've been using my Silpat, my silicon baking mat that I use in a sheet pan when I'm making cookies. I've been using it to knead bread just because I'm lazy and it makes cleanup really easy.
So you knead right on this Silpat?
Right on the silicon pad, yeah. When I have a particularly sticky, you know, a very stretchy, sticky, wet dough, like the kind of dough that you might have for a ciabatta.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to do it on the Silpat. So I've been doing that. And also, I have a beautiful, it was a gift actually, a wooden peel. That's the, I always think of it in terms of pizza. It's what the pizza guy uses to get the pizza
wooden.
Into
it's
the
wood.
Oven. It's wooden, right. I have a beautiful one made of burled wood. It's gorgeous. But I just saw one that's not pretty at all and absolutely great. The paddle is made of aluminum. It's about $20. Nothing sticks to it. It lasts a lifetime. And good for pizza, good for bread, good for getting a casserole out of the oven because it's really strong.
What about baking stones? Do you really think we need to use baking stones when we do bread?
Lynn, I've gone overboard. Not only do I use...
Why am I not surprised?
Not only do I use a baking stone, but I just bought a hearth kit, which is... It makes a little brick oven, like a little mini oven out of your regular oven. It's a baking stone
uh-huh.
that goes on the rack, and then baking stones that slip into it. So that on three sides, you have a three-sided box, and you lift your oven rack high enough so that the top of the oven makes the, one, two, three, four, makes the top side.
Right.
It really encloses the bread. You get a better crust. The color is fabulous. Yeah, you know. I love using a baking stone. Do you know why? I mean, there's actually a very good reason for it. Ovens, no matter how good your oven is, cycle up and down. Some ovens as much as 75 degrees. So if you set your oven to 350, at some point you could be at 275. A baking stone absorbs the heat and holds that heat. So as your oven is cycling up and down, that baking stone is still the same temperature.
Hence you get a better crust.
Exactly.
Aha. Hey, Dory, thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
Food authority Dory Greenspan is author of Paris Sweets. Her column, Tools of the Trade, appears every month in Bon Appetit. Well, speaking of equipment, we got this question from a reader of our newspaper column, Ask the Splendid Table. It said, Dear Lynn, how do you clean a cutting board? How long can you keep it? And what do you think of cutting boards with anti-contaminant finishes? Signed, Concerned Mom. Well, here's my answer. Dear Concerned Mom, the safest thing is wash wood boards with hot soapy water, then spray with bleach water. Let them stand a few minutes, rinse again with the hot water, and air dry. Now, for plastic boards, you clean them the same way, or you put them in the dishwasher because the drying cycle will sanitize them. But the thing you really need is two cutting boards, one for all animal products and one for produce. About how long a board will last? Well, if it's grooved and worn, you have created a wonderful hiding place for all those nasty microbes. Toss it. As for the anti-contaminant cutting boards, save your money. Those treated surfaces may slow down microbe growth, but they don't stop it. Talk about a false sense of security. Just stick with the plastic or the wood, and you're going to be in great shape. Coming up, California's stealth grape, great food on the cheap in New York City, and Alice Waters takes on school lunch. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. What we know as the boom in California wine is really a second coming. The first boom of excellent wine in the West happened in the 1850s. Now, back then, California was producing stunning red wine, and the best of the reds was Zinfandel. But of all California's grapes, Zinfandel is the most controversial. It didn't exist in Europe, yet it wasn't native to California, and everybody had an origin theory, most of them wrong. Enter one of California's leading wine historians, Charles Sullivan. He had a front row seat at California's 20th century wine revolution, and he became hooked on Zinfandel as an imbiber and as a scholar. After 30 years of digging, he's written Zinfandel, A History of a Grape and Its Wines. Charles, welcome.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Now, you hear constantly that Zinfandel is the one true American grape. I mean, the big marketing thing is this is the wine to serve at Thanksgiving because this is pure Americana. But is that true?
Well, you do hear that, that's sure.
Is it true, though?
Well, no, it's not an American grape. It's a European grape that came to America under very, you might say, strange circumstances, and then was developed as a very, very popular grape in California. But it definitely came from Europe, and it's a big question as to how they got here. I think I've figured it out pretty well, but there's still a lot of tiles to stick into the mosaic to get the complete story.
Well, you talk in the book about there being this great Zinfandel controversy. Now, what is the controversy?
Well, historically, going back to the 1880s, it was claimed that this Hungarian nobleman brought it from his estate, but it's not true. And the controversy today isn't so much a controversy as it has been a mystery. How can we have this grape in California, which is obviously a European grape? What's it doing here when there is nothing in Europe that has that name? So there's been this mystery. Well, that mystery was solved in the last 5 years by the scientists at the University of California, Davis. And their solution fits perfectly with the historical narrative that I've slowly put together. But, of course, I can't do DNA on a grape.
Right. Well, now, we should say that just about every other wine grape that's used in California can be directly traced to grapes in Europe, right?
There are a few very obscure ones which there are questions about, but no mystery because there aren't enough of them to make any difference. In other words, we just don't know. An example of that is something called the Cabernet Pfeffer, and we don't really know what that is, but who cares? There are only 11 acres of it in California.
Zinfandel
is a big, it's a big deal. I mean, how can we have this grape? And by the way, Zinfandel is a very special grape. It's good to eat. You can make raisins with it. You can make brandy. You can make sparkling Zinfandel. You can make a light table wine, you can make port, and you can make these heavy, monstrous, heavy alcohol wines. They'll age for years, or you can make white Zinfandel, which is really pink, or blush, and just gulp it down on a summer day. And it's tremendously useful in many different ways.
So tell me the history of this grape in America.
Sure. Okay. Well, this is the way I trace it. It came to the East Coast of the United States in the 1820s, probably 1829, and it came as a table grape, along with lots of other table grapes. Well, table grapes make pretty good wine quite often, so there's nothing magical about that. And the reason it was imported on the East Coast is there was a small industry in New England and in New York, Long Island, of forcing grapes early in a hothouse so that you actually were able to sell these delicious grapes when the snow was still on the ground in March and April. And in terms of constant dollars today, you could sell these for equivalent of $10 to $20 a pound. So there was this small industry. And, of course, the idea was to get better varieties. And
right,
this grape came in to one of these nurserymen in Long Island whose name was George Gibbs. And he showed it around up in Boston, and it caught on. Somehow he got the name Zinfandel, and no one knows. People have been guessing for 150 years where that word came from, and we have no idea. Anyone who says that he knows or she knows is full of baloney, unless they're right. But I mean, so far it's all been baloney. Uh-huh. So anyway, here it is. And then when the gold rush comes, one of the big sources of nursery stock to come to California in the very earliest days came from New England, because so many New Englanders came to California, and they brought grapes with them. And then by chance, two people, a nurseryman, a French nurseryman in San Jose, made a table wine out of it. And General Vallejo, Mariano Vallejo's winemaker up in Sonoma, discovered it. And there you go. By 1850, between 1859 and 1863, people who knew anything about what was happening in wine knew that there's this new mysterious grape that made such a delicious red table wine that could pass off as a French claret. And nothing much happened for the next 10 years. There may have been a few hundred acres planted, but then America went through a great depression in the 1870s, and when we came out of the depression, there was an agricultural boom, and there was a boom in viticulture, and the what people wanted in California was red table wine,
uh-huh.
And Zinfandel did it. So by the end of the 80s, the most commonly planted wine grape in California was the Zinfandel, and its reputation took off from there.
Charles, one grape. What a story. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
California wine historian Charles Sullivan is author of Zinfandel, A History of a Grape and Its Wine. Another piece of the Zinfandel mystery was solved by recent DNA tests. In the book, Charles reports that there are now Zinfandel triplets. A grape from Croatia, a grape from southern Italy, and the grape now in California. Their DNAs are the same. New York City is Mike Colomeco's beat. Mike's chef for some of the city's top restaurants. He's a food importer, and he does a TV show called Colomeco's Food Show. You can see it on New York's PBS Channel 13. Now, each show is about a different way to eat in New York. Mike focuses on a lot of my favorite beats, ethnic neighborhoods. Hey, Mike Colomeco, welcome back.
Hey, Lynn, how you doing?
I am just swell. And I'd like you to tell us today about that part of the city that's called Curry Hill.
I love to. I got to say, it's called Curry Hill because, you know, New York's neighborhoods have these names, and it's actually technically called Murray Hill, which is near Kips Bay, which is kind of Midtown East, but we've dubbed it Curry Hill because for about a 2.5 block stretch of Lexington Avenue, it's chock-a-block with Indian restaurants and Indian ingredient markets, all of which have a couple of things in common. The food absolutely rocks, and the prices are totally reasonable. This had been an Armenian neighborhood for the 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s.
Uh-huh.
And it's always a mystery to me how this happens. I mean, my guess is, just anecdotally, that an Indian gentleman was looking for real estate and found a spot on the avenue. He did well, told his friends, someone else got the next vacancy, and little by little it became this Little India. And literally now, nearly every storefront is an Indian video place or an Indian restaurant. Everything from kosher vegetarian to Chinese Indian to halal to you name it.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to profess to be an expert on Indian food either. That'd be silly, but I'm an omnivore, and if it tastes good, I eat it. And that's why I go there.
So where do you like to eat?
Okay, first stop, when you visit the neighborhood, you'll notice one thing right away. On both sides of the avenue, there's about 50 taxis parked on the meters. And this isn't Madison Square Garden or Penn Station. These guys are eating there. There's an Indian population in New York has grown a lot in the last decade. And,
right.
And they do a lot of service jobs, and they have to eat. So I think it's a great sign if you're eating at an ethnic restaurant when you're the only non-ethnic type there. You know, you're the non-Indian. And Handi, Hawandi, is just one of these. It's phenomenal. It's a cafe. cafeteria style. It has a movie, a TV that's always playing those Bollywood movies in the corner. And it has it's a cafeteria, so it has a hot bain-marie just full of things that change from day to day. But, you know, there's just the classics. The basmati rice with the chicken, the vegetarian food that's amazing. You know, India has this huge vegetarian population, and they do great stuff with eggplant and cauliflower. And, you know, most of the stuff I'm eating, I don't know. I just kind of point to it, look at it. You get four or five of these on a bowl with a soft bread, and it's heaven.
It's
and
a great way to taste, too.
It's a great way to taste is right. And you're out for like $12. It's phenomenal. Across the street is what's billed as, and the owner told me this, so I'm not going to doubt him, the first kosher vegetarian Indian restaurant in the city. It's called Madras Mahal.
Only New York.
Only New York. So why? What made you become? And he says, well, you know, we had a lot of Jewish customers in the beginning, and they said, you know, it'd be nice if you could get this kosher, because I have friends that would like to come. And how hard can it be? I mean, there's no dairy, there's no meat, there's no shellfish. So a rabbi comes in, does the inspection once a day, and they make this wonderful kosher vegetarian food. He's got this one specialty I love. It's called a paper dosa. It's a batter that's poured onto a grill and then spread out wider and wider with the cook's hand, like a big, long concentric circle. By the time he's done, the thing must be 2 feet in diameter.
It's a pancake,
It's a pancake. It's only cooked on one side, and then it's folded, kind of like a, I don't know, like a half cigar, just folded over itself, and they send that out with a bunch of side dishes to dip in it, and it's extraordinary. And the thing is stunning to look at. It looks like a cross-section of a 100-year-old tree or something. It's just beautiful.
Now, what about the grocery stores? I would imagine this is a great place to shop for ingredients.
It's the key, and that's really how I discovered it in the first place, was I needed some odd Indian ingredients for a recipe. A friend recommended Kalustians, which is an Armenian name, but the Indian gentleman bought it back in the 70s, kept the name, and at Kalustians, they specialize in couscous, rices, and spice. Spice is integral to Indian cuisine. It's what drives it, spices and herbs. One of the things he does that's spectacular is he brings in all the spices whole, and he grinds them fresh himself. And the difference is huge, because once it's ground, it begins to lose the esters and the quality. Well, he just grinds it as he needs it. And, you know, I walked in there the first time. I thought I knew about couscous, and, you know, couscous is couscous, right? Mm-hmm. Nah, the guy's got 20 kinds of couscous. 15 kinds of black peppercorn. I mean, you walk around there and you just, you know, you spend $50 before you know it. You bring the stuff home and your wife goes, "What's this?" Well, I couldn't resist. But it's that kind of a neighborhood. Now, for a little more upscale, a few blocks away, is a restaurant called Tamarind. It's off Park Avenue South. The owner was the previous owner of Dawat, which has been an Indian, really a landmark for years, restaurant in the city. And it's wonderful. He brought in chefs from England, chefs from India, guys that just do breads. And it's if you want upscale Indian and spend a few more dollars, I mean, he's just got guys that'll do the naan and the roti and the garlic bread. There's a bread called puri that is a deep fried bread that just puffs up like a huge bladder that they bring to the table that's really tasty. All the side dishes are great. The entrees are cooked in these gorgeous tandoors, a wonderful wine list to match, and it's my choice for Indian upscale in Manhattan.
Well, Mike, thank you. Now we know Curry Hill. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Lynn.
Chef and food importer Mike Colomeco covers the New York food scene on his PBS series, Colomeco's Food Show. Now, if you don't have an Indian grocery nearby, check out Asian and Middle Eastern and Latino markets, because they share a lot of the same ingredients with India. My first love from the Indian grocery is tamarind concentrate. I use it almost as often as olive oil. It tastes sour but fruity and really rich. I buy the concentrate because it's easiest to use, and once opened, it's going to keep months in the refrigerator. You can put tamarind in all the usual dishes. It's great over ice cream and fruit, and I love to use it to marinate meats. Now, the basic marinade I use is canola oil, tamarind concentrate, garlic, fish sauce, and chili. I like to pour it over pork tenderloins. Now, if you want to get my recipe, tamarind glaze pork tenderloin saute, it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Here's a new idea in this age of obese young people. Get school credit for eating real lunch. Well, this is what legendary chef and activist Alice Waters is proposing. Alice joins us from Berkeley, California. Alice, it is good to talk to you again.
Well, thank you.
All right, woman, what is this latest plot? What are you doing?
Well, I think we need to take school lunch out of the sort of maintenance side of the equation and put it in the academic side of the equation.
Now, how do you propose doing this?
Well, I think we have to look back at the way that something like physical education was put into the academic curriculum, and the students got credit for taking physical education. And it came about because we were worried about kids being physically fit. And we put a lot of money and a lot of effort into engaging them in a curriculum that regularly became part of their school day.
All right. Okay.
And we bought equipment and we built gymnasiums and we hired teachers. And that's the kind of effort that needs to be made now because we have such a health crisis in front of us and we need to really pay attention and reach every single child.
What are the specifics of this, Alice?
Well, we are beginning to develop the specifics of this. We've been working already on a sort of interactive project at Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School called the Edible Schoolyard for the last 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been trying to bring kids into an experience in the garden and in the kitchen that helped them to understand about sustainability, about the ecology of this planet, to engage them in the beginnings of learning to cook. And we found that they love it, that this was their favorite class at school. And we knew at the same time that they were learning this whole different set of values, that they were really learning to become stewards of the land. They all knew what compost was. They all knew how to make a vinaigrette for a salad. And it just came through this curriculum that connected the courses that they were having already, their history course or their science course or their math course. And they brought the students from those classes out into the garden or the kitchen to be learned in a different way.
Uh-huh. Now, you want to take this national? I mean, do you think this is going to work nationally? I'm just thinking
of
the logistics of this.
I really believe this is the only way that we're going to reach every single child in this country. If we begin with a curriculum in kindergarten, and we're going to build this idea into the whole plan for the day, and it's going to be developed in such a way that it meets the educational standards.
Well, Alice, it's impressive. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
Award-winning chef and activist Alice Waters created the Edible Schoolyard program at Martin Luther King Middle School in Berkeley, California. Well, guys, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Going back to the story of Zinfandel, what was America's first grape fad? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can visit them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question goes back to the story of Zinfandel. And the question was, what was America's first grape fad? If you listen closely to our guest, Charles Sullivan, you may know the answer. America's first grape fad wasn't about wine. It was about hothouse grapes, a brand new idea way back, would you believe, in the 1720s. Now, these were perfectly trimmed bunches of grapes coaxed into gorgeousness out of season, and only the rich got to taste them. Now, I want you to compare this. Think about today's seedless Thompson bunches in the supermarket, 99 cents a pound. In the 1700s, if you could get your grapes on the Boston market by April, you could sell them for what today would be $25 a pound. And by 1830 in London, hothouse beauties cost $50 a pound. Somehow this gives a whole new meaning to peel me a grape. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have Bob on the line from Edmond, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what do you want to talk about?
At this time of year, I have an abundance of jalapeno peppers, and I have a garden that I devote basically to herbs and salsa.
My kind of man.
Tomatoes,
yeah.
Garlic,
you got it. You got
onions,
it. Yep.
And peppers.
Uh huh.
And a couple of years ago, before I put in the garden, and I started making salsa, I would find on occasion chipotle peppers, dried smoked jalapenos.
Right. Exactly.
At some of the nicer grocery stores, but I couldn't find them all the time. And so last year I thought, well, I'm going to raise my own, and I'm going to smoke my own peppers, make my own chipotle to put in my salsa or other sauces. And my attempt at doing that was terrible.
So what happened?
So when I would smoke them on my first couple of attempts, mm-hmm. and I have a dome top smoker that you put charcoal and mesquite wood and so on.
Right, yeah.
And I tried that, and I got limp. I didn't get the dried peppers that I had found in the grocery store, and I'm looking for something that I can save through the winter so that when I want to make a new batch, you know, I can reconstitute them and so I could store them dry.
Yeah, exactly.
And I got these, you know, they were burned on the outside and, green on the inside. It really didn't turn out. So I'm wondering if you have... Now that I have a bushel basket full of jalapenos.
And you really want to smoke them. Yeah.
I
have never done it, but this is my thought. The first thing you have to do is dry the pepper and then smoke it. So that would mean a little dehydrator or a very low oven would do the trick. And I think what I would do is... they would have to be on a rack so air can circulate over them and under them. And maybe 150, 200 degrees, 150 maybe. Or, you know, dehydrators aren't wildly expensive. And, you know, they control the heat beautifully and there's air blowing and that kind of thing. But I think one of the keys is that first the chili is dried, then it goes into your smoker essentially for flavoring. And I understand what you did because it's exactly what I would have done. But as you were saying it, what occurred to me was, gosh, when you get chipotle chilies, they're almost brittle because they're so dry.
Right.
And they're intensely smoky. So I would dry them just about all the way, and then I would put them in the smoker.
Okay.
See what happens. Do it with a small batch and see what happens, because I think we're talking about dehydrating them maybe in a dehydrator overnight.
Okay. Okay.
You know, maybe 16, 18 hours. I haven't dried chilies in a very long time. I have no doubt also that in some places, like in Mexico, they're dried out in the air. But the problem is by that, by the time you figure out how to do it just right, the rest of that bushel basket is going to be toast. So, but that's what I would do.
I'll experiment this year and I'll let you know how it turns out.
All right. Please do. Please
Thanks,
do. Lynn. Hey, you're welcome. And you know, enjoy the salsa.
Thanks.
Take care. Goodbye. Bye-bye. Call us, guys. 800-537-5252. We have Jody on the line calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hey, Jody, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
My husband and I were at the local farmer's market a couple of weeks ago. And we have a favorite garlic farmer that we buy all of our garlic from. And we noticed that they were selling squash flowers. And she was, and she had mentioned that, oh, yeah, people buy these. They fry them. They eat them. And to me, I mean, they're just, they're fuzzy, you know. I just don't know how that could be enjoyable. But my husband actually just fried some in oil, and they taste good, but they're still fuzzy.
Did you eat the stem? Is the stem fuzzy?
Yeah, the stem. Well, no, we just, it was mainly just the flower, and I guess a little bit of the stem at the bottom of the flower.
But the flower was fuzzy.
Not as much as the stem, like the, I don't know what it's called between the part that holds the flower onto the stem.
Oh, I know what you mean. I know what it's called either, but it's like a little pod almost, yeah. And the petals mm-hmm. come out of it. This is the thing. When I was testing recipes for my last book about Italian country food, because I grew up on squash flowers.
Yeah.
You know, my Tuscan grandmother would grow zucchini for the flowers.
Mm-hmm.
The zucchini we gave away, but we wanted those flowers.
Right.
And we ate them constantly, and they're just a wonderful summer celebration mm-hmm. food. But when we were testing recipes, we went to the market and we bought squash flowers.
Right.
And what we discovered was that zucchini flowers tend to be very tender and sweet and delicious. Mm-hmm. But that other squash flowers can be fuzzy. Some of them can be bitter and whatever. So we decided that, heck, play it safe. Do only flowers from zucchini.
Oh, okay.
And it's the male flower you're picking.
Okay.
The female's
okay.
on the end of the squash.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get them fresh, and all you do is, the way I love to do them, is about a half inch of olive oil in a big skillet.
Mm-hmm.
You beat up some egg. You add some salt and pepper to that. And then I dip the flour into the, and I keep the stem. I don't necessarily eat it, but I keep it as a handle. Dip it
right.
into the egg, let it drain off, and roll it in fresh breadcrumbs, and then pan fry it. It's crispy, and it's delicious,
oh, wow.
and you think you have died and gone to heaven.
Oh, well, my husband will be so excited.
Oh, just tell him. And you know what you do if you're going to share it with friends? I don't believe in sharing because sometimes there's never enough, but you eat them as they come out of the pan. You know, you just bring up stools to the stove.
Oh, yeah.
And you drink a really fresh, light wine, like a Frascati, you know, from near Rome, and you're in Italy.
Wow. Thanks so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy.
Okay.
You take care, Jody.
All righty. Bye, Lynn.
Goodbye. Easiest, most wonderful thing. Dip an egg, dip in fresh breadcrumbs, drop in a little bit of fat, and let them get nice and golden brown and crunchy. Drain them on paper towels and eat. 800-537-5252. We've got Steve on the line from Fort Smith, Virginia. Steve, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. A quick question for you. It's about a preparation for salmon. My wife and I were in Paris last year, and we stopped in one of those beautiful little bistros in the left bank, you know, just popped into one. And she got a salt-crusted salmon, which was roasted. It was beautiful. You know, it was medium rare, and it was like silk. And since then, we have tried, you know, to do the salt crust preparation. And I hate to say it, it always comes out like a salt lick. Is there a trick to this?
Have you used high heat?
We usually try to roast it at about 400 for just a couple of minutes.
Because did you get the cooking down?
It couldn't see him do it, obviously.
No, what I'm saying is, was this at that timing and that temperature, was the salmon cooked the way you wanted it?
Well, it always comes out a little overdone, actually. I just can't get the medium rare thing just right, but, you know, that's practice, I guess.
You know what I'm wondering? Because, you see, you have to salt. In this case, you'd have to pack it in heavy salt, you know, like kosher salt.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what
because,
I use.
Yeah, that's great because it doesn't have any additives and stuff in it.
Right, yeah.
And you put it into something that's heat-proof so that you've got about a half inch of salt at least all around the salmon. But you don't let it sit around. You get it right into that hot oven because otherwise the salmon's going to start absorbing the salt like crazy.
Huh, okay.
And so that may be part of the problem.
Okay.
The other thing that occurs to me is I wonder, what I'm thinking is when you brine something, this sounds like we're defeating our purpose here, but maybe not. Mm-hmm. When you brine something with a, you know, with a mixture of sugar, well, a mixture of salt and water and usually sugar as well,
yeah.
It plumps out the cells in the fish, right?
Okay.
And it does season them. But they're not going to absorb any more, I don't think.
Huh.
I would do two things. Number one, I would just pack it and stick it right in that oven and maybe bring the heat down about 25 degrees.
Okay, to 375?
Yeah, or leave it at high heat, but cook it for less time.
Okay.
So remember, 10 minutes to the inch max.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Pardon me. The other thing to think about is to take... let's say, for argument's sake, a third of a cup of brown sugar, a third of a cup of kosher salt, and about a quart and a half of water. Stick the fish in that, put it in the fridge for a half hour, pull it out, drain it off, rinse it, pat it completely dry, pack in the salt, and then throw it in the oven and see what you get.
Hmm. Okay.
And you may actually get something quite remarkable.
Anything with salmon is remarkable in my book.
Exactly,
but,
exactly.
You know, it's hard to miss, but, you know, this was just such a beautiful presentation. I mean, only the French can do it.
Exactly, and I just wish I had my science degree hat on because, but packing in salt and roasting in salt goes back as old as the hills, you know, chickens done in it and all kinds of things. And you get some saltiness, but I think the key is to move it as quick as possible.
Okay.
And don't let it absorb.
I appreciate it.
You are more than welcome, and, you know, give us a call and let us know how it turns out. In the meantime, when I get a chance, I may just do a little reading.
I appreciate that.
You know, you're getting me to thinking, I think I may want to do salt roasting.
Okay.
Hey, thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Lynn.
Goodbye.
Bye.
You know that old business about show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are? Well, there's a home furnishings company that says, show me the style of your kitchen and I'll tell you a heck of a lot about yourself. The company is IKEA and they've done a survey of 1,000 people in North America. They tried to relate our kitchen style to how we live. IKEA's design spokesperson, Janice Simonson, is on the line. Janice, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how did you break down kitchen styles?
Well, we looked at some general types of style, going to a little more edgy, trendy kind of things is maybe perhaps our most extreme, ranging to old-fashioned as the most traditional kind of style that we looked at, and then everything kind of in between.
Okay. But it broke down into four categories, didn't it? As
yes,
I remember,
it.
Yeah, okay. Now, two things played in this that I was rather surprised about.
Uh-huh.
One was politics.
Yeah.
And the other one was romance. Tell me about how politics played in all of this.
Well, we did find that people who did have a little more kind of edgy, trendy kind of kitchen were a little more politically involved. Another thing were people that had televisions in their kitchens tended to talk about politics at the dinner table much more so than people without.
And what about romance?
Romance, well, people that were happiest with their kitchens had a tendency to have more romantic encounters in the kitchen, which isn't very surprising, I don't think. I think the happier you are with your space in general, the more likely you would be to enjoy your life in general in any way. So...
if I designed my kitchen to be very sleek and very modern, would I perhaps find more romance in it than if I had a kitchen, let's say, that was very traditional?
Well, that's what our findings seem to show.
Oh, it does show up that way.
I think it's just in general people who have a little more of a, let's say, liberal attitude towards things had a tendency to be a little perhaps less inhibited. The edgier design kitchens tend to have more romance. Not only that, but get more help doing dishes from their spouse or significant other. And another thing that we found was they're more often likely to drink directly from the container of the milk. So there's that only, there's a very few overall themes. That was one definite one.
I love it. There's one last thing, though, that really I have to ask you about. What you wear influences how often. You talk about politics, the apron thing. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, that's a hard one to draw a conclusion. We did find that respondents who wore aprons in the kitchen were more likely to talk about politics at the kitchen, 29%, compared to ones that don't. What that means, it's hard to say. Maybe it's people who want to get down to business and don't care if the fur flies and the sauce flies a little bit. Perhaps that's what that means.
I think in this political climate, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to apron sales. Hey, Janice, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Janice Simonson is design spokesperson for IKEA North America. Well, guys, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Robert Heinlein. He said, yield to temptation. It may not pass your way again. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And don't miss our free weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, made possible by Organic Valley, an independent cooperative of family farmers bringing fresh milk, juice, butter, eggs, and cream to your local supermarket every day. More information available online at organicvalley.com. Additional support for our program comes from Starbucks, now offering Black Label exclusives, rare small lot coffees from the far corners of the world. You can discover a unique coffee treasure. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.